sweet lord.
Mildred watched from the window. She stood immobile as the train pulled away and watched it slowly ease along the tracks, away from Fairburn. Finally, she turned and looked at Christy, who was hunched on the bed, her knees pulled up to her chest in fetal position, her hands over her ears.
Come on, Christy. Time to go.
I don't know what you're talking about. Huh?
I'm sorry, Christy, but we have to go. I have to find Ryan, and I think it's best if you stay with me. You understand that, don't you?
Of course.
After a moment, Christy opened both eyes and pulled herself up, swinging her legs and feet over the side of the bed.
What happened?
They took Jack.
Ryan and his two companions were walking back toward Jemmy's bar and hostelry.
So, what did you two find out? Nothing we didn't already know, Doc.
As the trio crossed the street, they saw Mildred burst from Jemmy's, followed by a tired Christy. JB ran the last few steps to meet them, and Ryan and Doc increased their pace behind him.
What's going on?
Jack's gone. He jumped the wall to get a closer look at that monstrous thing that...
What monstrous thing?
The train. Didn't you see it? Didn't you hear it, at least? It shook the ground, Doc.
We were in the arena, the dogfight. It was mighty noisy in there. The crowd all excited and the hounds going at each other, hammer and tongs. Quite the experience. Which way did he go, Mildred?
Mildred hefted the backpack on her shoulder, pointing in the direction of the tower.
The train stopped beside the tower, and I think they did something to it. I'm not sure what. It was all very quick, like they had done this before. The whole operation took no more than 4 minutes. Jack was out there the whole time. He sneaked up really close so he could observe and report back. Figured it was something worth knowing about. But they took him, Ryan. They took him, and then they left.
Fire blast.
What are you planning on doing? Chasing after him on foot?
Well, what would you suggest?
JB smiled as he indicated the corral behind him with his outstretched thumb.
I would suggest that we travel in style.
Ryan was already sprinting down the street, heading for the corral at the far end, and JB kept pace with him. Mildred looked torn, her head flicking to watch Ryan.
Go. I shall take care of Christy. Now that she's on her feet again, I think we can just about take on the world between us. She will probably be carrying my weary bones by the time we catch up to you.
Thank you.
While their companions raced to the corral, Doc led Christy in the opposite direction. She rushed along in his wake, struggling to keep up. At the gates, Doc studied the cantilevered system for a few moments. One of the sentries atop the gates, a strong-looking farmhand, 21 and toughened up by a life of manual labor, noticed him and made his way down the wood stairs.
Hey, what do you think you're doing? Do I even know you?
In a single movement, Doc snapped his cane open, revealing the sword blade hidden within, and had it pointed at the young man's throat.
I will be requiring these gates to be opened instantly.
When the young sentry saw the blade that was poised at his neck, he collapsed in a dead faint. Doc squinted at the lock, trying to fathom how the system of pulleys that opened the heavy gate worked. Then he just shook his head and pulled his shining lama from its holster.
Rope A, fulcrum, point B.
He blasted a hole through the middle of the rope with a single load from the weapon's shotgun barrel. He shoved open the gate, which was now unattached from its pulley system. Ryan and the other two galloped up and slowed just enough to leave behind the two horses that they had taken from the corral for Doc and Christy. Then they galloped out into the night. Doc and Christy mounted up quickly and took off after their friends. They were quickly bumping up the incline just outside the bill.
Doc, stop!
Doc turned to Christy. He was hesitant to call a halt to their chase so soon, but he also worried about the young woman's health.
What is it, Christy? Are you...
Christy was already out of her seat, running back toward the ville. Doc admired her as she ran. There was something of her lithe grace returning to her muscles, though she seemed a little unsteady as she wended toward the open gates of Fairburn. She was 12 feet behind him when Doc saw her bend and take something large and shiny from the ground. Then she turned, ran back, and Doc saw that she clutched Jack's .357 Magnum Colt Python.
Jack would never forgive us.
Yeah.
Ryan, JB, and Mildred rode side by side. To their left, the train tracks continued in a slight curve across the sandy landscape, barely visible in the moonlight. JB was trying to get the facts in order in his head.
You say they took Jack with them?
Definitely. I saw a half dozen of the crew lead him back to one of the cars, then push him inside.
And he was still alive?
They took him alive, but I don't know how long they'll keep him that way.
Why would they want him, Mildred?
I wasn't close enough to hear what they said. I could barely make out what was going on once they flicked the spotlights off. All I know is that Jack ran to the gates and a group of men followed him. I heard two shots, and then the men reappeared, marching Jack to the train.
JB?
Who knows why anyone would want Jack?
If he's still alive, we'll find him. And if he's dead, then we're gonna chill every last segment on that train.
The segment had marched Jack beyond the locomotive engine and the first 10 wheeled units that it pulled before one of them opened a door and shoved him into a car. Jack had kept his head low, hands weaved behind his neck, left arm burning with pain, and tried to keep track of everything he saw. The engine had been painted a matte black so as not to pick up reflections. It shrugged off the moonlight, a shadow looming large against the indigo sky. Holes had been molded into its casing through which burning coals glowed reddish-orange. It was almost 40 feet tip to tail, and the majority of that space was dedicated to burning the fuel that powered it. An open plate at the end showed where the engine worked the controls. Above the engine, near the strange figurehead that jutted from the front, a wide chimney belched puffs of steam while the vehicle stood at rest. Once it got moving again, that smokestack would blast a dense fog into the air around the train. Just as Jack had seen on its approach, creating a misty cloud through which it seemed to battle to its destination. Behind the engine stood a chrome container unit, and Jack guessed that this held the fuel that powered the beast. It was a long unit, almost as long as the engine itself, and Jack could see putrid yellow symbols indicating radioactive material within, as well as the coal. Cars followed. The first was a flatbed open to the elements, with a large cannon affixed to its surface. If necessary, Jack guessed, this would be the first line of defense should any unwelcomes approach the steel behemoth. After that, a series of boxes on wheels, glass window panes catching the moonlight. Jack guessed that these held equipment, since one of these cars was where the spotlight trolley had appeared from. The next two cars looked similar to each other, like large wooden crates with narrow horizontal slits where the planks met, and a set of steps at each end, leading up to an open doorway. Inside the first doorway, Jack saw a sec man watching the group that passed with a prisoner. The man held a large bore shotgun in his hands and trained it on Jack as he passed. Jack was hustled up the steps of the car. Inside, the interior was intensely dark, and Jack blinked his eyes several times in an effort to adjust. Out in the open had been dark enough, but the inside was pitch black. Then a man behind him lit an oil lamp and followed Jack up the steps.
Come on, get in there!
Jack looked around the narrow car. Floor-to-ceiling grillwork stood immediately in front of him, with a bolted gate in its center. The grill acted as a cage, closing off 4/5 of the car. Through the grill, Jack could see eyes staring at him. Scared, timid eyes, wet with tears. As his guard jostled him forward, the oil lamp picked up more of the room, and Jack saw that the eyes belonged to about 8 or 9 children, dressed in dirty rags, and cowering as far from the mesh gate as they could.
Welcome to your new home, sonny.
Another sec man had joined them, and he unbolted the gate, brandishing a remade Beretta at the children in the cage.
Here, your new friends. You get inside.
Jack looked at the gun's muzzle, then up at the sec man's eyes, and a snarl crossed his lips. The sec man raised his gun. The albino teen sat still, watching the man's eyes, waiting for that flash of determination that meant he was going to pull the trigger. Nothing. Just a bluff. A wicked smile crept across Jack's face as the man lowered the blaster. And then Jack saw the twitch in the eyes, the defining moment, and the man quickly raised the Beretta to Jack's chest. The horse's hooves thundered against the ground beneath her. Mildred and her steed tried to keep pace with Ryan's horse. JB and his own horse had deliberately dropped back behind the group, and the armorer had his mini Uzi hidden in his lap, covering his companions in case things got bloody. They could see the train ahead now, a little below them where the ground sunk. The companions charged downhill, following the tracks as they endeavored to catch up. Ryan leaned in low to his steed's neck, letting the wind from the train's slipstream pass over him. There were 3 horse lengths between him and the rear of the moving train, and he urged his horse on with a kick of his heels in its flanks. A man crouched atop the train, holding a long rifle pointing into the air. Rear guard, obviously, but a pretty stupid one in Ryan's opinion. The man was paying no attention to the track behind the train, and the noise of the train's passing masked the galloping approach of the horses across the sandy plain. Enough, at least, that the man didn't bother to check. Ryan knew the type. He was lazy because he was bored by the routine. The one-eyed man was in reach of the train now, though the horse kept shrugging away as Ryan guided it toward the moving vehicle. He patted the horse's neck, trying to calm the animal, as he pulled the reins to the left, guiding the horse closer to the back of the train. There were no doors here, no way in from the rearmost car, but he could see bars of metal stretch up the side, a ladder. Ryan reached out for the nearest of the horizontal bars as the wind whipped all around him, slapping him in the face and pushing his reaching arm backward. He urged his mount on with another jab of his heels. He needed to get up that ladder and kill the sentry before the sec man knew what was happening, otherwise the whole crew might be alerted. Ryan reached again for one of the metal rungs and felt his little finger whisper against it. He stretched his arm a little farther, teeth gritted as he strained his muscles for the extra reach, and suddenly snatched the rung in a firm grip. Taking all of his weight on his left arm, he kicked the horse away beneath him. Suddenly, he was dangling by one arm, watching his mount run off into the wilderness, the ground hurtling 3 inches beneath the toes of his combat boots. Then he had swung his other arm around, and he was climbing the ladder, pulling himself up as his feet swung over empty space. Ryan powered up the ladder, hurled himself over the rim of the car, and onto the roof. The sec man with the rifle turned as he heard or felt Ryan's boot slap down on the roof. He made to cry out, but Ryan's fist pounded into the man's windpipe.
Suck on steel, you motherfucker.
Ryan stepped back, yanking the blade of his pongo from the sec man's gut. Ryan watched as the man bounced along the tracks 3 times, before finally coming to rest as the train sped away. JB and Mildred were trailing along the left edge, urging their mounts to keep pace with the train. Ryan crouched and looked down the length of the roof and along the consecutive rooftops that traveled up the line ahead of him. There were a few sec men on the nearby rooftops, but none close enough to cause the companions any problems. Ryan scrambled across the roof and, lying flat on his belly, dipped his head over the edge and checked each side in turn. They were the same, a simple ladder arrangement built into the metal sides about 2/3 of the way along the car. In the dark, it was hard to be certain, but the car appeared to be made of molded steel, cold to the touch. Halfway along the roof was a lumpy square, and Ryan crawled swiftly along to examine it. Some kind of drop-down hatch. He put his ear to the entryway and listened for any echoes coming from within. He failed to discern anything. He quickly worked his way back to the ladder on his left, the right-hand side of the car, and looked over the side. Mildred's horse was keeping pace, and she was looking up at Ryan, waiting for his signal. He held his open hand out to the side, fingers splayed. Clutching her horse's neck, Mildred shrugged the bag from her back and held it up against the side of the car. Ryan leaned down and grabbed for one of the backpack straps, yanking it onto the roof. He rested it there as quietly as he could, trusting its weight to keep it secure for the few seconds it would take to get Mildred aboard. It took 2 tries, but Mildred's reaching hand finally locked onto one of the low rungs of steel, and she pulled her body, still atop the horse, closer to the train. Ryan grabbed her arm and pulled her up and onto the train. JB was next, passing up Ryan's SSG-70 Steyr before he clambered up the ladder. Before long, the three of them sat together on the roof, establishing their next move in a series of rapid hand gestures. Ryan indicated the roof hatch, and they moved toward it in walking crouches. The three of them surrounded the hatchway, each assuming his or her role for the next part of the operation. On 1, JB flipped the latches, and on 0, he had the hatch pulled back toward him, opening the doorway in the roof. Feet first, Ryan dropped through the opening. The room was dark, the only light coming from the night sky through the open hatch directly above him. He could sense objects all around him. A few glints of metal caught his eye, but he couldn't see anyone else in the car.
It's clear. Come on down.
Mildred dropped down first, her target revolver still in hand, and JB followed, Uzi at the ready.
Dark as a blacksmith's rag in here.
JB pulled the roof hatch back in place. He fiddled in one of his jacket pockets for a moment and produced a glow stick. The glow stick emanated a dull green iridescence, filling the car with long shadows. Ryan scurried to the front end of the car and stood next to the metal door that had appeared with the increase in light. He put a hand on the doorknob, slowly increased the pressure on it, and felt the door give, opening a bare inch. He pulled the door closed again and examined it for a locking device of some kind, but couldn't find any bolts or turnkeys.
Door's unlocked.
One of us needs to watch that at all times. Can't be entertaining uninvited company.
Mildred sat cross-legged on the metal plate floor, 4 feet in front of the door, and held her ZKR loosely in her hand, her eyes focused on the door handle.
Got it. You boys look around. See if there are any toys to play with.
Ryan and JB checked the small room rapidly as the glow stick continued to fizz out its greenish hue. The walls held strong steel shelves at the tail end, and the shelves were piled with train parts in various states of deterioration. Some even looked shiny new. There were heavy wheels for the rolling stock, jars and other containers filled with rivets, nails, and screws. Large sheets of metal lay atop one another in a huge stack, and JB found another group standing in one corner, wedged in the gap where two shelving units met. They located 3 acetylene torches for welding, and JB shook one to see if it had any fuel in it.
Storeroom.
Repair shop. These people are well prepped for life on the move. Smart place for it, too, all this heavy metal at the back of the train. It would do double duty as armor if anyone tried a rear assault. They've thought this through. Probably not the only one, though, train this size.
Any medical supplies?
Nothing seen.
We got everything we need to barricade both doors, but I don't know if there's any real reason to do so.
Safety?
How safe would it be if someone blasts the car and unhooks the couplings? Find ourselves in a hot coffin with both exits well fortified to stop us getting out in a hurry.
Point taken.
So, what do we do? Take in one car at a time?
No. We just look around for now. Make some decisions once we get the lay of the land.
Millie, do you remember which car they took Jack into?
It was relatively close to the front section, about the 10th or 12th car from the engine. I didn't really get a sense of how long this thing was until we were above it.
Yeah. We need a way to get to the right car. Any ideas?
Along the roof?
A lot of segment up there. Can't rely on all of them sleeping on the job like my pal back there.
If we knew what was in the car...
Reckon we're gonna have to find out.
They were about 10 miles out from Fairburn, traveling in a southeasterly direction.
Mostly southerly.
JB consulted his tiny compass by the eerie light of the glow stick.
But I saw some curvature to the tracks that suggests we'll loop to the east. Ultimately, we're gonna have to get much closer to the front if we're to locate Jack. That means working through the car somehow. Any idea what we can expect to find there, Mildred? You're the only one of us that saw the folk who worked this thing.
Quite a few Sekmen came off the train when it stopped.
You know, how many is quite a few?
More than a dozen, but I didn't count them on or off. I was trying to keep one eye on Christy.
We understand, Mildred. Go on.
I saw maybe 15 men. Some of them were giving out orders, I think. Our window really was quite a long way from the action, Ryan. The whole plan was that Jack would do the scouting and report back.
Pretty thin plan.
Well, I guess we're gonna have to take us a look-see outside. See how far we can get.
Pretty soon someone's gonna notice that the rear guard's gone. It's pretty dark out there, but they will notice if they don't see a body sitting up top.
What are you saying?
One of us should get up there, keep their head down, and hope they don't get challenged, at least till Doc gets here. Anyone want to play ringer?
I'd like to keep an eye out for Doc. Make sure Christy is all right.
Ryan?
Your build is closer to their lost comrade, JB.
JB stepped across to the roof hatch and reached up to unseal it.
Good point.
He climbed back out onto the train's roof. Ryan offered his hand to help Mildred off the floor.
Ready, Mildred?
Doc urged the pony on in pursuit of the train.
How does it feel now?
It's a lot better.
Christy pulled her jacket around her to stave off the cold wind that had whipped up around them.
My head feels much clearer now. Like the pressure's going away.
Any thoughts about what was causing it?
The closer we got to that ville, the worse it became.
And now that we have departed the area...
Maybe there was something there affecting me. Never felt that before.
It is certainly most peculiar. And yet, Fairburn seemed... almost impossibly normal, friendly place, a real sense of community.
Perhaps I've been on the trail so long that I cannot bear to be near normality.
It was not just hallucinations, Christy. At one point, when we were nearing the ville in question, you were beset with a sudden, inexplicable nosebleed. That is more than a simple adverse reaction.
I don't even remember. Did that really happen?
Something in that ville was working its way deep inside you, and removing you from there has proved itself a most fortunate decision.
What about the train of screams? Could that have done something to the wiring in my head?
Well, I've considered that possibility, but it does not ring true. You were affected long before the train came to Fairburn. In fact, you were at your worst long before the engine appeared. If anything, its appearance coincided with an overall improvement in your health.
Apart from the imaginings of my ears.
Do you still hear it now?
A little, if I listen for it. But it's real quiet and far off now. What's gotten into me, Doc?
Doc shook his head. He had no answer. The wind blew in Mildred's face as she stood in the open doorway to the lattermost car on the train. When she looked down, she could see the ground rushing beneath the cars. The metal tracks, two parallel streaks caught in the periphery of the green light cast by JB's ebbing glow stick. 2 feet ahead of her, close enough to reach, stood another open door, mirroring the one she stood in, the entryway to the next car in the monstrous train. Ryan had just stepped through it and disappeared into the dark shadows within. Mildred crossed the gap and stepped through the open door, her target revolver held upright in a two-handed grip. The car seemed to be about the same width as the one she had just exited, and she could just about make out trace lines of bluish light trailing along the sides. Other than that, the room seemed to be in utter darkness.
Clear. Keep going. Watch the crates.
Mildred pushed the door behind her, silently closed, then walked the length of the car to join Ryan at the next door. They checked 5 cars, each subsequent car increasing the tension in Mildred's mind. The whole while, Ryan remained calm, treating the opening of those doors as routine. The cars had been stuffed with various supplies, all of them ephemera one might associate with the construction of steam engines and train tracks. There was a lot of unpainted metal, sheet steel, and solid pig iron, cut into various shapes and sizes for ease of storage or for specific uses. Ryan proposed that the majority of it was probably intended for what would basically amount to patching the engine and cars as required. Aunt Mildred had voiced her wonder that the train was built so shoddy as to need a constant repair kit to hand.
What's the weather like in the state of North Dakota, Doctor?
I don't know.
Me neither. But I've seen toxic clouds full of pollution and radiation right across Deathlands. And I don't imagine that Dakota is somehow different. Wind blows the wrong way. You could probably see whole hunks of this train burned through by an acid storm.
Mildred nodded, looking around the car they were in, seeing the supplies in a different light.
Pays to be prepared.
3 of the cars had at least one window. One of them had one whole side devoted to reinforced glass. When Mildred had taken a closer look, she had recognized a sticker still adhering to one of the panes. This was windshield glass designed for automobiles before nuclear Eschaton had changed the world. Never used for their original purpose, the windshields had been placed upright and secured by welded spots to form the joins. When they got to the 6th door, Ryan paused. He was standing on a minuscule sill below the far car's door, no more than a lip of metal where the door and floor failed to meet correctly, the ground between the tracks hurtling by 4 feet below him. He turned back, stretching one leg across the gap between the 2 cars, and wedged his foot there, propping himself over the open gap.
I don't like it.
Should we go back?
Ryan hung between the doors a moment, considering options. Finally, he stepped back into the car with Mildred, closing the door behind him.
We've been lucky so far. No sec men, nobody. I saw a light under that door, so it's likely there's someone in there. Maybe a whole mess of someone's.
We'll have to face them sooner or later. We could wait for Doc and Christy, have JB with us too, and go in guns blazing.
Or we could do it quiet, stealth, just the 2 of us.
And maybe not need to do it at all.
What?
I was just thinking about the problem being 2 doors. Back in medical school, one of my lecturers told me an anecdote about trying to find an obstruction in a patient's large intestine. He was using a tiny camera that fed through a thin wire inserted in the patient's mouth, but he and his team just couldn't find whatever it was that was causing the patient so much pain. And then the lecturer told us, I remembered something quite fundamental about the human body. And he pointed to his anus.
So the doctor put the camera.
The lesson that he taught the class that day was to always remember that the body is 3-dimensional. If you can't get in one side, alter the tangent of entry.
Mildred pointed to the door at the far end of the car, the one through which they had entered.
Every car we've been in after the first has had 2 doors beside the sliding side panels, Ryan.
Some of them have had 3. One in the roof or one in the side.
You enter that car through the back door here, where it's all unmanned storage, lockers on wheels. Whoever is in there is likely going to wonder where your gateway is. Am I right? But if you enter via the front door...
Up, over, down, through the door. Then we introduce ourselves to the local players.
Without arousing so much suspicion.
The real question is whether we can go up and over.
Ryan went back to the door between the cars and gestured for Mildred to keep well back. She stepped backward to the center of the car, still clutching her ZKR, and tried to remain alert as Ryan disappeared out the door. Ryan had lifted himself so that his head was above the rooftops of the cars, both fore and aft. He checked the one behind first, saw no one there, then his head whipped around and looked at the rooftop of the car he intended to cross. Empty. He dropped back to the rear car and encouraged Mildred to follow him. Then he was back out the door, lifting himself up the fore car by the strength of his arms alone, letting his legs swing below him until he could kick them over onto its roof. Ryan quickly scurried up onto the roof, then helped Mildred get up as well.
Sick, man. Two cars behind us. Another at 12 o'clock. Three lengths ahead.
Mildred squinted, trying to make out the dark figures against the night sky, noticing the light cast from the windows of the car below them on the ground beneath.
Got him!
Don't think either of them will give us trouble, as long as we move quick. It's dark and it's noisy out here. And they're probably posted to look over the edge for attacking locals or muties.
Not checking tickets. Got it.
Together, the pair prowled across the curved rooftop in quick, quiet steps. Halfway across, they dropped to the roof and lay flat. Ryan held Mildred's hips as she dropped her head over the side of the train and looked in a lighted window, just a fraction of a second to assess the scene before she reappeared on the roof.
Compartments!
They got up and made their way stealthily to the far end of the car. At the other side, Ryan dropped like a stone. Mildred dropped flat on the roof surface again, bracing her legs and swinging down. She hung upside down between the jostling cars in front of the door, her gun ready. Ryan pulled the door open and entered. Ryan clutched his Sig Sauer as he stepped into the car. The walkway stretched along the left wall, which had three large windows evenly spaced along it. To the right were compartments, just as Mildred had advised. Glass partitions and wooden frames, their contents hidden by heavy, moth-eaten curtains. There were four compartments in total, and each had a glass and wood door in its center. Ryan silently indicated for Mildred to join him. Swinging on the door frame, hands clutching the top, she dropped to the floor of the car very quietly, closed the door behind her, and unholstered her revolver once more. Ryan stood outside the third compartment, his back to the wall, Sig Sauer held shoulder high. Mildred stood opposite the door to the compartment, her own revolver ready, and nodded firmly at Ryan. Ryan raised the Sig Sauer and entered the room in a series of swift, fluid movements. The small compartment was dimly lit by an ornate oil lamp hanging low on the ceiling. A bunk stood to the right, a curtain pulled across it, and to the left, a chair sat in front of a small shelving unit with a mirror and a large washbowl. A large curtainless window, almost the whole width of the compartment, looked out across the passing countryside, dabs of green speckled between the sandy yellow soil. There was movement in the bunk behind the curtain, and a hand appeared, hairy knuckles reaching to pull back the curtain.
Who the...
Ryan shouldered the bunk's curtain aside and leaned one knee on the man's chest, thrusting the Sig Sauer into the occupant's face. An ugly face stared back at Ryan from the wrong end of the barrel. Piggy eyes narrowed in reams of pallid flesh, unshaven jowls hanging heavily beneath. The man's eyes were full of questions, all of them murderous. But he remained silent as he looked at the one-eyed man, bare inches above him. JB kept lookout at the back of the train, unconsciously checking the hilt of the technoknife he had hidden in one sleeve. On the horizon, where the deep blue of the sky met the solid black shadow of the earth, JB spotted a movement. The train was going downhill, a subtle incline, and it meant that he was looking upward. He squinted and saw the shape of two horses coming towards him. JB thought about the car below and whether there was anything he could use in there to help Doc and Christy get on board. Rope, maybe, or some kind of wire he could turn into a lasso. As he looked behind, he saw a man approaching, one roof ahead, and closing the distance carefully, keeping his balance low with a crouching shuffle of movement. As he watched the man approach, JB eased his index finger beneath the trigger guard of his Uzi.
Nate! That you, Nate?
JB sized the man up in his mind, watching him jump across the gap between the car and land at the end of the one JB waited atop. About 6 feet tall, maybe 240 pounds, all of it solid muscle.
Nate! Hey! You ain't Nate! What happened to Nate?
Stomach problem.
Little wonder. All I see him eat is crap. Name's Given. Sean Given.
John Dix, you my relief?
Yeah, man. And did you say your name was Dix? You're not Tish's old man, are you?
Cousin.
Woo! Thought I just walked into an ambush for a minute there. I didn't walk into an ambush, did I?
Hey, what my cousin does is up to her. None of my business.
I'm real sorry I'm so late, man. You go get yourself some sleep. I got this covered now.
JB got to his feet. He was rapidly considering what to do next. Doc and Christy were on their way. The last thing they needed was a firefight with this stoop. At the same time, if the armorer killed him now, he'd only up the possibilities of raising suspicion. The ante had been raised high enough with their boarding the train, and the trusting sick man's naivete had granted him a lucky break. He made his way to the far end of the car roof, looking back at Sean Given sitting there, the wind catching his long blonde hair. Doc or Christy could handle this dope, and neither of them would be stupid enough to approach the train without checking for guards. For now, JB was going to have to retreat and see if he could locate Mildred and Ryan.
Where are we going?
Ryan pushed the barrel of his gun further into the man in the bunk's forehead so that the man sunk down in the pillow.
What is this train's destination?
I...
Where? Listen, you little worm. That thing you feel pressing against your forehead is the end of my blaster. I'll shoot what little brains you have right at the back of your head, and no one will hear a damn thing over the racket of the engine. No one will come running. So you answer my questions now. Are you gonna have yourself one bastard headache, you understand? So, where?
Forks, man! The forks!
Now where the red blazes is that?
North? South? I really don't know. I can't think of any forks. Maybe it's a nickname.
I'm looking for a friend of mine. He was taken on this train against his will.
The man in the bunk just looked at Ryan with those wide, scared eyes.
What are you, sick man? Is that it?
Yeah.
You take prisoners? You do that?
Sometimes. Just kids, though.
Just kids?
Maybe sluts sometimes. I'm not sure.
Be sure.
Yeah, gaudy sluts. Good-looking girls who should be gaudies, you know, guy.
No. My friend is young-looking, very distinctive. He's an albino. You know what that is?
No.
It means he's white. Pure white, like snow. You get snow here? You've seen snow?
Yeah, I see snow. Wintertime.
My friend's skin and hair are colored like snow. You wouldn't miss him.
You don't remember?
You haven't seen him? What?
I ain't seen no one, man. Please. Please don't chill me.
Ryan took the gun away from the man's head, but continued to point it at his face.
You are going to have to remain very quiet for me if I'm to let you live. And you're going to have to prove irreplaceable in your helpfulness to me and my people. You think you could do that?
Anything, anything at all.
Ryan stepped back slowly, his Sig Sauer still trained on the man's face.
I can sedate him if you want.
I don't think that would be necessary. Our friend here just wants to play along. Isn't that right, friend?
The man spun in the bunk, launching his right hand at a cubbyhole above his shoulder, obscured from view by the pillows of the bunk.
But screw you!
He pulled a snub-nosed 38 from the cubbyhole and swung it around to target the intruders.
I thought we could sedate him if he became rowdy.
Didn't seem like the sedating type, Mildred.
The sweat was foaming on Doc and Christie's horses. They had been racing across the North Dakota plain for far too long, and their animals were near exhaustion. However, they were definitely gaining on the train now. Doc could see its obscene length slithering along the tracks, a giant black caterpillar crossing the land, smoky steam belching from its foremost segment.
I think it may actually be slowing.
Oh.
Christy, dear! Christy, are you feeling unwell?
The screaming is louder.
We're getting closer to the train. Perhaps we were wrong in our earlier summation. It seems to be having some effect on your faculties after all.
It's that, but it's not just that.
What do you mean?
It's so hard to tell. My brain feels like it's on fire. But there's something... I can't tell if it's just inside me now, alive and eating away at me.
Oh, you poor child. My profuse apologies.
Christy closed her eyes a moment, and when she opened them, Doc could make out the watery tears in the moonlight.
Oh, it hurts so much.
Silently, Doc agreed with her. It hurt him, too, deep inside, seeing his companion in so much pain.
Hear that?
Ryan cocked his head, trying to filter out the sounds of the train to divine something new.
What?
High-pitched squealing. That's brakes. We're slowing down.
Ryan moved across the tiny compartment and looked out the fly-specked window.
You're right. Any ideas why?
Pit stop? Station? Food run?
Doc found out something earlier.
I never had the chance to tell you. There are other towers. That's what he was told.
It doesn't surprise me. I didn't give it a thought until you said it, but it doesn't surprise me, not really.
Ryan continued to stand at the window, looking this way and that, trying to make out details in the moonlight. As she watched him, Mildred realized just what it was he was really looking for. Christy and Doc were still somewhere between here and Fairburn.
You know, Ryan, I shouldn't have left Christy.
Mildred took two steps forward, unable to stop herself moving as the train stopped. Ryan, she noticed, didn't move at all. His thick legs were planted rock solid on the floor of the train, his uncanny sense of balance holding him firm. Once the train had stopped, Ryan turned and went to the door.
Come on.
Mildred followed him, and they jogged down the corridor toward the door through which they had entered the car. As they reached it, the door at the opposite end opened, and Mildred spun, dropping to one knee and targeting the newcomer with her revolver. JB stood in the doorway, his own weapon, the compact Uzi, in ready position. When he saw Mildred and Ryan, he lowered his gun and gave a single firm nod.
We stopped. We're a long way from the front. Going by what Mildred said, I'd guess that's where the action is. We were planning to go take a look-see, find out what's what.
Ryan opened the door, then reached up to the roof of the car. In a moment, he was up and over. Once there, he lay down flat and looked up the length of the train. It was too dark to make out details. He unslung the stire and rested it in front of him, then looked down the powerful scope, adjusting it until he could see to the front of the train. A handful of people were walking around, most of them armed SecMen. A few others rushed back and forth, receiving orders from a dark-haired foreman who held something shiny and metallic in his hands, probably a weapon. The one-eyed man panned the scope slowly across the area, tracking a group of three serious-looking people, a dark-haired woman and two men, one of them older and sporting wispy white hair. Lit by the glowing light of the train engine, Ryan watched as this group made its way to an area off to the side of the tracks. As they left the faint light of the engine, he lost them. Then a bright light suddenly broke the darkness in the scope's image. The train people had a method to light the area. A little pool of light as bright as day had appeared where the group waited. Ryan watched as the group had a quick discussion, gesturing to something to the right. He panned the scope slightly, and there it was, spitted in the X of his crosshairs, gleaming in the brilliant light as it lunged into the sky, was another skeletal tower, just like the one outside Fairburn.
Fireblast.
While Mildred kept watch, JB joined Ryan on the roof of the car to discuss the situation.
So why did you come find us, JB?
My position got relieved. Sick man came over, spoke to me, saw nothing out of the ordinary in my being there. I told him I was filling in.
There was frantic activity through the scope as Ryan watched. A group of the raggedly dressed sec men leapt from the train and ran toward a nearby copse. The remainder of the group continued to work at the tower.
Something's going down. They have a big sec force, easily infiltrated.
That's my conclusion, too. None of them are uniformed. Walk tall, they won't bother us, I'm thinking.
Sounds risky, but we need to find Jack. I don't think we have a lot of options here.
Ryan continued to watch the activity through the scope, never shifting his position. JB's gaze swept the rooftops of the train in the moonlight, pinpointing where the roof guards waited.
Any sign of Doc?
I think I saw him and Christy.
You think she'll be all right?
Ask Mildred, I don't know.
Doc and Christy pulled at their reins. They were close to the train, barely 200 yards away, and Doc knew that it was only the cover of darkness that granted them protection. Above them, the silver moon danced through the clouds, its light sporadically bright on the landscape. Doc could see a man on top of the last car of the train, cast in silhouette against the indigo sky.
I need you to look for me, Christy. Locate the sect men.
Christy slumped in the saddle beside him, her head lolling on her shoulders, her eyes scrunched tightly closed. Doc wondered what folly had made them think to move her from Fairburn and to let Mildred leave her side. She had seemed better, he reminded himself. What had happened? What was going on with Christy?
Muties.
JB's head whipped to look in the direction that Ryan was watching through the powerful magnification of his scope.
Where?
Trees, 2 o'clock.
Ryan observed through the scope as a group of sec men fought with the naked humanoid figures. The muties numbered more than 50, and they moved with grim determination. The Sekhmen's bullets slowed them, but the few they felled would collapse for a moment, only to struggle back up and continue the attack. Scalies, probably. Thick leather skin protecting them against small arms fire. Suddenly, Ryan rolled over and shifted to a sitting position, looking at JB with his single, piercing blue eye.
Time to find Doc and Christy.
They leapt from the roof, returning to Mildred, where she waited in the car beneath them.
Back of the train, Mildred.
What is it, Ryan?
Mass chilling going on outside. We need to get Christy and Doc on board before someone chills them, too.
I didn't hear anything.
It was up front. Muty scuffle. We're best keeping out of it.
But if they spot Doc... When they reached the penultimate car, Ryan clambered up between the coaches and took to the rooftops again, with Mildred and JB following. The sec man, Sean Gibbon, was still atop the roof of the last car.
Hey, man, what?
Ryan jumped across the gap between rooftops.
There!
Ryan pointed to the left of the train. JB and Mildred followed where he indicated, spotting the horses coming toward the train from the shadows. JB was down the side ladder in an abbreviated second, waving his arms above his head to show Doc it was safe to approach. The sec man had left the children in the 12th car alone. The group had sat there, huddled together, as far from the pure white youth as they could get. All of them watched the thin figure lay there, saw him jostled with the heavy movements of the train as it hurtled down the tracks. They watched him roll away from them toward the front of the train when the brakes were applied, until he finally rolled over, slapping softly into the grill mesh when the train stopped. His eyes were closed, and he hadn't reacted when his body had hit the ringing metal of the mesh wall, not even with a grunt of expelled air. Humblebee, 9 years old and a passenger on the train for 3 long days, finally plucked up the courage to ask the question that had been troubling her.
Maddie?
Maddie was Humblebee's best friend on the train. Maddie was a lot older, but she was clever and funny. She had made up stories to help Humblebee sleep on her first night on the train, after she'd been snatched by the train pirates.
What is it?
Humblebee could tell that Maddie was watching the white-skinned boy too, but she didn't dare avert her gaze from the stranger. She was behind Humblebee somewhere, and Humblebee wished she could hold hands with her now when she asked the scary question again.
Is that boy a ghost?
I don't think so.
Why is he so white? He looks like a ghost.
I think he might be dead.
He's not dead, Mark. Don't say that. It's a horrible thing to say.
Humblebee looked at the ghost boy, trying to see if he was breathing, but she couldn't see any movement.
That man shot at him.
If he wasn't a ghost when he got on, he probably is now. Chilled.
Stop it.
Why would they give us a ghost?
For eating.
JB helped Ryan wrap a blanket around the corpse of the pig-eyed sec man he had shot and shove it into the overhead luggage rack. They used the soiled sheet from the bed to wipe blasted brains from the wall. Then Mildred helped Christy into the bunk. The companions had moved in silence through the cars, alert to possible discovery. Once they reached the perceived safety of the compartment, a hushed conversation brought everyone up to speed.
Why is the train stopped again?
There's a tower up front.
Another one? I did not see it.
Long way to the front.
How far?
Over a quarter mile. Hard to tell with the dark, moving object, no landmarks.
Oh, by the three Kennedys.
They felt the train begin to thrum. JB gestured to the dead sec man in the overhead luggage rack.
It might be easiest to toss a body overboard once we pick up speed. Cloud cover may hide it, but if not, anyone who sees it will probably think he slipped. Don't reckon they'd stop the train to check on one man.
Have you located Jack?
Not yet. Mildred thinks he's close to the front, maybe 10 or 12 rail cars from the engine.
Yeah, I reckon the train's about 60 cars in total front to back. So far, all we've seen is storage, but as we get nearer the front, we can expect to see more people. The bunks here won't be the only ones. There's a sec here, but they're badly briefed. I passed myself off as one of them with the rear guard. Didn't even raise an eyebrow. Figure if we keep our heads down, no one will question me or Ryan.
We'll work through the cars, try to find Jack. We'll plan it from there.
Doc was shaking his head, clearly deep in thought.
What is it?
Now, the lad is plenty resourceful. He may well have found his escape route and be off the train already.
In that case, he'll find us. Or we'll go back to Fairburn, make our apologies, and wait for him to appear. Last rendezvous protocol. Jack will follow that.
Assuming he is on the train, however, how long do we have to find him?
Sooner the better.
You have missed my point, Ryan. This train has to go somewhere, even if it is just to refuel. The next stop may very well put us in a situation we are ill-prepared to handle. There could be 1,000 armed men waiting at the end of the tracks for all we know.
And my point stands. The sooner the better.
Doc's right, Brian. We may not be able to just rush Jack off. Might be a shedload more to it than opening a door.
The previous occupant of this bunk told us they were heading to the Forks.
Mean anything to you, Doc?
Grand Forks, in the northeast of the state.
We're traveling south, but there's a curve to the tracks. Could be taking us easterly. Hard to say yet.
The redoubt that we exited said Mineth on the wall. Whereabouts is that?
JB placed the washbowl on the floor and laid a map on the small desk it had sat on, flattening the paper with a sweep of his hands.
Here's me now, northwest, in Grand Forks. Here, 150 miles as the scud flies, but if we're looping around, who knows? Could take a week or more, especially if we're stopping.
You know anything about this Grand Forks place, Doc?
I'm afraid I've never been there. Or if I have, I do not remember doing so. It is still hard to remember much of what I've done. Some of it is so vivid. My times with Emily and the children, but other things.
We get Jack, we do it quiet, and we get off. If we don't go looking for a ruckus, we can hopefully avoid getting ourselves into one. Low profile all the way.
Ryan looked across to where Christy lay in the bunk. She seemed to be sleeping, but her fists were clenched tight, nails digging hard into her palms.
Mildred, you're gonna have to do what you can for Christy until we get off this thing. JB and I'll scout the train. Doc, I don't think you'll pass for a sec man, sorry to say. So that puts you on watch for Christy and Mildred.
And two more delightful companions no man on Earth could ask for.
Same rules as ever. Everyone's backup. We're three people down with both Jack and Christy out of action, and someone watching her at all times. So we don't draw any attention we don't need.
Do you think this cabin is safe?
Storage cars behind might be safer, but we have to think of Christie's comfort. Plus, at least we're out of sight unless someone actually comes through that door. We'll live with it, unless something more secure presents itself. How's Christy?
Her health is declining again, Ryan. I can't see what the pattern is, but she's almost as low now as when we reached Fairburn.
I have hypothesized that it may be something to do with the towers, but since we do not know where they are, nor what they are doing, it is hard to come to a definite conclusion.
It's a sound theory, but why would it affect her and not us?
It's hard to say, Ryan. Anything I tell you now would have to be pure guesswork.
No point.
Well, keep her comfortable.
I'll try.
Mildred could almost feel the cold breath of the Grim Reaper blowing softly over her shoulder, standing just beyond the edge of her vision, waiting to claim Christy for his own. After a short discussion, the companions had decided to sleep in shifts, making room where they could on the floor of the cramped cabin. Ryan had been keen to continue the search for Jack, but eventually recognized his need for sleep after some persuasion. Inside, all he wanted was to get out there, find Jack, and get off this awful train. But as soon as he sat on the floor beside Christie's bunk, he felt his muscles locking, his head getting heavier, as tiredness caught up with him. Sleep was welcomed by all of them. The trek across the wasteland outside Minot had been exhausting, and none of them had had time to stop for very long except for Jack back in the Fairburn lodging room. JB and Mildred took the first watch. The train stopped three more times during the night, and each time, whichever of the companions was on watch, had sneaked outside to see what was happening. The train people were working on more towers, though Mildred noticed that they passed several others without halting. Doc was awake for one of the stops, and had taken Ryan's stereoscope to observe the action at the front of the train, much as Ryan had earlier. The land was becoming greener, and they had passed occasional tributaries of clear water, shining in the moon glow, sometimes even crossing them over rickety bridges. The tower stood near one of these tributaries, set back 20 feet from the rail tracks. When Doc looked at the magnified image, he realized that this tower was still under construction, its skeletal frame ending roughly, not reaching to the high zenith of the others. The foreman of the SEC team spoke to a man whom Doc realized had already been on site, and the three intellectual types had joined in with a flourish of maps and notations passing between them. A small construction crew sat waiting to go back to work. Just three men, including the one who spoke with the train people. He jumped back on the train from his crouched position beneath, bringing the stire with him, and returned to the compartment. He stood at the window, a step back so that he wouldn't be seen, and studied the tower as the train trundled past. The construction crew was already back at work, the bright blue jets of welding torches clear in the darkness.
Curiouser and curiouser.
The companions were awake when the rays of dawn peeked over the horizon and began to shed light in the cramped cabin. The air in the enclosed space had become warm and stuffy, smelling of sweat and leather from their boots. Christy sat up in the bunk, her knees pulled tight to her chest, gently rocking with the movement of the train.
Maybe I should give her some kind of sedative.
No. If trouble comes calling, we'll need her awake.
Doc told them about the construction work he had seen during the night. JB tried to marry the readings from his mini-sextant with the topographical information presented on his creased maps, but he couldn't work out precisely where they were yet, let alone where the towers they had passed were located. The train pulled to a halt, just as Ryan and JB were checking their weapons in preparation for their search for Jack. Mildred stood at the window, looking up and down the tracks to try to see what was happening.
Another tower?
I can't see any.
Ryan slung the stire, rolling his shoulders to accommodate the familiar weight, and indicated that Doc and JB join him as he entered the corridor beyond the cabin. The three of them paced swiftly down the corridor, and Ryan opened the door at the end and lowered himself down between the adjoining cars. He pressed against the forward car, looking toward the front of the long vehicle. First, JB, then Doc, peeked out to see what he was watching. All around the train, at a distance of roughly 20 yards from the tracks, stood a fence. Pieces of corrugated steel stood next to wire mesh and wood panels, and some of the fence was made up of tree trunks, branches removed but left rooted where they grew, the panels of the fence slotted around them. The fence never fell below 7 feet in height. Not an impossible climb by any means, but certainly a deterrent. A few SecMen strolled slowly around the perimeter, guns in their hands. A set of chain-link gates had been closed at the far end behind the train. The compound made an effective stopping point, easily defended from local interference, but Ryan realized it might also double as a prison for him and his companions if they weren't careful. The air held that fresh smell that Ryan associated with the ocean shore.
Some kind of stopover.
Saluting the dawn like dirt-poor primitives.
Ryan beckoned JB forward, and together they sneaked silently alongside the train toward the ceremony, leaving Doc to wait at the juncture of the cars. They walked past 18 cars, two of which had rounded sides, making them bloat outward like a well-fed boa constrictor, and both men silently committed the details of each one to memory.
This is not a good idea.
JB continued walking straight ahead, his gaze set on the participants of the ceremony as they laughed and spoke among themselves.
Too late now.
Ho, brothers!
Ryan and JB felt a wave of relief when the SecMan offered them no challenge, but Ryan could see the tremoring in the man's stance that indicated jolt dependency. High on an ultimately lethal drug, the man was probably not the most observant of the train crew.
You're not late. They aren't paired yet.
They noticed that other SecMen were still stepping from the train, joining the pack that waited in the rising sunlight. Ryan counted around 80 sectypes in all, as well as the gaudies and a handful of weaker-looking men who were mistreated, kicked at, spat on, and berated as they trudged through the group. As Ryan watched, a few more SecMen joined the crowd, hopping down from the roofs of the train cars and bringing the grand total up to perhaps 90, an effective little army. All of the guards were armed, but there was no uniformity to them. Their weapons and clothing were individual. Many of them carried guns, though some had simpler weapons, such as knives and swords. Ryan saw a scimitar glinting with the rays of the sun, a machete stained with coppery rust. The sky was a bright shade of red above them, the rising sun blazing over the horizon, casting long shadows of the group in the train. Rain-heavy thunderclouds blew through the sky, blotting the rays of the sun for brief moments as they drifted onward. Ryan scanned the crowd, but there was no sign of Jack.
He's not here.
A burly man wearing a dark-colored vest walked toward the crowd from a car near the front of the huge train. Wide-shouldered, the man walked with a heavy, determined tread. He wore a gun holstered low on his right hip, a leather tie securing it just above the knee. As he got closer, Ryan could see that the man had several white-streaked scars across his face and down one arm. Behind the scar-faced man came three people, a man and woman in their 30s, accompanied by a much older man with wispy white hair and spectacles perched on his nose. Ryan had seen all four of them before, when he had watched the activities at the second tower. Scarface seemed to be some kind of foreman, giving out orders to the SEC crew. The other three had been working at the tower when the firefight with the Scalies had broken out, and Ryan recognized their type. White coats, or similar, definitely brainy types.
We're at journey's end for the night, brothers. Anyone who needs sleep or company can take it. The bridge comes alive in 2 hours, and we'll cross Sacagawea then and be on our way. Until then, day shift in place. Construction crew with me. Everyone else, use the time wisely. We've got a lot of track to cover, and I don't need anyone falling asleep.
We're 3 stops behind schedule.
Why?
Well, that's really not down to me.
The preliminary tests have been encouraging. If all goes to plan, this should be the last go-round. Then the Baron will be able to move on to Phase 4.
Ryan and JB couldn't help but notice the smiles and looks of relief on the faces of some of the SEC crew at this news. JB also noticed several SEC men pointing across in their direction and talking among themselves.
Ryan, time to go.
Ryan didn't question his colleague. He simply took 2 steps backward, as though trying to get a better view of the speakers over the crowd. Then, he and JB turned and walked back toward the rear of the train. Behind them, the conference continued.
Interesting. I don't know what it is we've stumbled into, but I'm thinking it looks mighty big, JB.
Agreed.
JB pointed ahead to an open door on the side of a car, and Ryan took the lead, jumping up onto the raised step and ducking through it. JB followed, trotting up the step and out of the sunlight.